Welcome to the scorching arena of valor and the crucible of courage. This is the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Here in the inferno of life's greatest challenges, heroes are shaped and legends are born. Every episode is a torchlight of wisdom, casting a glow on the paths walked by those who've braved the flames and emerged stronger. In this furnace of fortitude, we'll explore tales of resilience, bravery, and the unyielding human spirit. Each guest brings their own spark of insight, lighting up the darkness and guiding us through the smoke of adversity. With Fireman Rob at the helm, prepared to delve into conversations that smolder with significance and stories that kindle the soul. It's not just a podcast, it's a beacon for all who seek to rise from the ashes and glow with purpose. So stoke the fires of your curiosity and ready your heart for tales of triumph and transformation. The flames are roaring. The stage is ablaze. Welcome to the Forged in the Fires podcast. Let the journey begin.
All right, welcome back to Forged in the Fires podcast. I'm your host, Fireman Rob. Today, I have an amazing individual who has been to the other side and back. He is constantly striving to be the best person. He is a Navy veteran. He actually, well, let's get into the story. I don't want to ruin the story too much because I want Keegan to do it. Keegan Gill, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
You know, your story is iconic, and I wouldn't do it justice in the beginning, and I want to start with it because I think it talks a lot about your who you are and what you're about and what you continue to do. So can you take me back to that time? So you are the only pilot, the F-18 pilot to survive the fastest ejection in the history of naval aviation. Can you take me back? I know you've probably told the story many times, but can you take me back to that?
Yeah, I'm happy to share it. So it was January 15th, 2014. I had completed naval flight training. I was a winged aviator. I did a year of training in the F-18 Super Hornet to complete what's called the Category 1 syllabus. And I had been at my first fleet squadron, VFA 143, the Puking Dogs, in NAS Oceana.
What was that again? The Puking Dogs?
Yeah, that's the name of our squadron, the Puking Dogs. There was a whole lot of political correctness controversy.
They had to
switch it back for a while, but it's back to the Puking Dogs, at least the last I heard.
Before
the PC police shut them down again. I had been in my squadron about 8 months. So I was no longer the FNG, but I certainly was pretty low on the totem pole and still learning a lot every day, drinking out of the fire hose of knowledge that is strike fighter aviation in the Navy. And just learning every day on this particular flight. As I was getting ready, my buddy Fisty's at the SDO desk standing duty. So he's managing the phone and running the radio and coordinating the flight schedule, which all the pilots would rotate through, throughout the week. Anyways, as a joke, Fisty, who's always doing stuff to lighten the mood a little bit in this high stress world, he had put up on one of the whiteboards in the squadron right behind him, as I remember it, this big whiteboard with all the working areas, all the airspace we were going to be utilizing that day drawn out from an overhead view. And underneath it, he had drawn all the position of these GPS tagged sharks that were out in the Atlantic Ocean that day. So he had the Shark Tracker app on his phone. He was able to look us up. It just so happened that on that day, there was this 16-foot, 3,500-pound great white shark named Mary Lee directly underneath the airspace I was going to be utilizing. Also checking the buoy temperatures that day for the water temperature to know if we had to wear dry suits or not.
Yeah.
The water temp was at 37 degrees Fahrenheit, so near freezing ocean temperatures. Below freezing air temperatures
and a big ass
shark. So Fissy being the guy is, he joke, hey man, it'd be a terrible day to eject.
Oh my God.
And have to go down to that ocean. So we had a good laugh about that. As I'm getting ready for the flight, I brief, and as I'm coming out on another whiteboard in the ready room, they had all these lists of potential call signs for guys in the squadron. And I had been there 8 months. All the other guys that had joined with me, and even after me, a lot of them already had call signs for typically for doing something really dumb or something that stood out about you that's embarrassing. And I had just played the small mouth, big ears card really well. I hadn't really stuck out in any way. And so one of the senior pilots in the squadron, Basil, came up and he's like, "Hey man, you just haven't done anything dumb enough yet to earn a call sign."
Oh God.
So I go and I walk on this flight. I get all dressed up in my gear with, G suit, a harness, vest, and I'm wearing a Jehemix helmet that day that I just gotten qualified with, which is a joint helmet mounted cueing system. It's sort of the space age visor.
Oh, wow.
Everywhere you look with your helmet, in your visor, it displays information from your weapon systems, from your radar.
No kidding.
And it's a really cool piece of kit. Wow. It costs about, at that time in 2014, it was like $280,000 for one of these things. So it's frowned upon for you to drop one or lose it or break it.
I can imagine.
But it's really cool. I was still kind of getting used to it. It's just like any new piece of equipment. If you haven't quite gotten the time with it, the proficiency, it can be a little bit of a distraction, which became a factor in my flight that day. Anyways, we went out, took off. I was in my jet. My flight lead was my commanding officer, my skipper that day. And then my friend Buddy, call sign Hipster, was flying a tanker jet. So it was a Super Hornet. They had just had a ARS refueling pod come out of maintenance. Okay. And they wanted us to go up and just take some air-to-air refueling plugs out of this thing and see if it worked properly. So Hipster flies off in that tanker jet. My flight lead and I take off, join up, and go out to the area about 50 miles off the shore of Virginia Beach over the Atlantic Ocean. And we start doing some plugs. So I put out a fuel probe on the nose of the jet, fly up very gently behind. And Buddy puts out the basket. So that thing's kind of flying behind the jet with a fuel hose attached to it. And you fly up and plug into it. And all that went well. So we were fortunate to have extra fuel, extra airspace, and some time. And whenever we get that opportunity, one of our most favorite things to do is to go out and practice dogfighting, or as we call it, BFM, basic fighter maneuvering, which is probably the epitome of what people think when they think fighter pilots. It's a couple jets trying to shoot each other down within visual range. It's a lot of G, you're diving, climbing, banking, all over the place, trying to engage. And obviously in this case today was with simulated weapons, but we can simulate those things pretty accurately.
Right.
Anyways, we set up, we do several rounds of this fighting. It's like getting in the ring with Mike Tyson for me. I'm like the white belt and he's the triple degree black belt or whatever.
Mike Tyson's punch out, you're like you're the little guy trying to punch him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just the way you learn though. And time after time again, he kicked my ass, but I was learning little by little and practicing with the Jehemix helmet and getting that invaluable experience, which is really what shapes and develops you as a pilot.
Right.
And we got towards the end of the flight, we hit what's called Joker fuel. Okay. So we had just enough fuel left to knock out one more short set of fighting as we transited home towards Oceania. So we set up a little bit lower, a little bit faster than we typically did, called 3-2-1 fights on, and we pitched our jets in at each other, sort of like two medieval knights coming at each other in a jousting match. Only our closure rate, is like 1,000 miles per hour plus coming in at each other. And as we come into each other's paths, we stay about 500 feet apart from each other for safety. I cross his path. He crosses mine in the opposite direction. I kind of look over my shoulder. I'm already partially inverted, so almost upside down. I continue to roll the jet completely upside down, inverted, and then I pull it in what's called a split S maneuver. So it'd be like a big dive down at the ocean.
In
this big vertical maneuver. Now, typically you can execute that maneuver in under about 5,000 feet. We started the setup at 12,500 feet. So over 2 nautical miles up in the air, the ground wasn't an immediate concern of mine.
Yeah.
When we met the merge, we were still above 10,000 feet. So I should have had plenty of space to execute this, but in just a few seconds, that jet had accelerated while I was distracted using this helmet. And I didn't realize the airspeed I had gotten up to. I pulled the jet. I started diving down at the ground, and all would have been good and well, except the aircraft thought that there were bombs on the wings that were not there. And in the Super Hornet, you are only a voting member in the flight control system. So I have the stick in my lap. I'm commanding this thing to max perform turn, except it's using the air data computers and all these algorithms to figure out exactly what to do with the flight control surfaces. And thinking that there were bombs on the wings, it reduced the G available. So this would be like going around a sharp corner in a sports car and then having the steering wheel kick back halfway. Only instead of skidding off the road, I'm now skidding down at the ocean in this vertical dive, diving straight down.
Oh my God.
In the few seconds that I mean, this all just happens in a few seconds. I didn't fully realize what was going on with the flight control system. All I felt was I went from about a 7.5 G max performance pull, which to explain what that means is we're sitting here probably at 1 G, most of us sitting on Earth. So say I have a helmet and my head combined weighs about 20 pounds at 1 G. If I'm pulling 7.5, almost 8 Gs, that's now like having almost 150, 160 pounds on my head that G-force. So you can feel that in your neck and your body.
Yeah.
My body weight over 1,000 pounds, just getting mushed into the seat. I'm straining, I'm breathing, and all I felt was that all ease up all of a sudden. Oh. And, you know, my stomach sank. I'm just stuck in this dive at the ocean, and the ocean is rushing up at me. In the few seconds I had to figure it out, I pulled the throttle to idle,
yeah.
put out the speed brake, but it was too little too late. And at about 2,000 feet above the ocean, which was, 2 seconds before impacting the water, I was traveling at 604 knots indicated airspeed, or 695 miles per hour.
That's
equivalent to 0.95 indicated Mach. So 95% the speed of sound. And this is basically, I'm at the sound barrier. This is the speed where back when they were originally trying to break the sound barrier, back in the 50s and 60s, the engineers were saying, hey, you cannot go any faster than that. There is this wall of air at that speed. You cannot break the speed of sound. It's impossible.
Right.
So that's right where I'm at. 2 seconds before impacting the water, out of a desperate attempt, last chance survival, I pull the ejection handle. And a normal ejection is pretty violent. If you're straight and level below 200 knots in a controlled situation, it'll still cause spinal damage and flail injuries. I was well outside the survivable ejection envelope. But I had no other choice. As they came out and impacted the sound barrier with my body, well, one, there's this rocket booster that goes off under the seat, and you pull about 50 Gs instantaneously, followed by 12 to 14 Gs sustained rocket booster. And that's enough to compress your spine permanently.
Oh, my God.
And then as my body exits the aircraft, I hit that airflow, and that airflow ripped my helmet off my head, smashed my head into the seat, causing a brain injury. My face just got battered by that wind.
Yeah.
It was like basically just getting smashed in the face for 15 rounds of boxing. My face is all black and blue and swollen. My arms flailed violently, causing my left forearm just shattered the radius and ulna, severed the median nerve, which controls my left hand. I had bilateral humerus fractures. So both my upper arms shattered. My right humerus tore through my right brachial artery, causing rapid internal bleeding. And my left scapula, my left shoulder shattered. My arms are just flailing violently. The gear on my survival vest just shredded off my body. I was wearing a dry suit, but I ejected so fast that it shredded the dry suit open and shredded that thing and left it tattered. It literally almost shredded the clothing off of my body. It was so fast. My legs flailed around so violently with steel toe boots on that each of my feet essentially became like a medieval mace, and it smashed open my tib fib and my lower legs, causing fractures in my lower legs. Chunks of my tibia are falling out into the ocean to chum the water for Mary Lee. He's probably circling around down there. I pulled the ejection handle at 2 seconds before the jet impacted the water. By the time that ejection sequence initiated and completed, it takes about 0.4 seconds.
Yeah.
So just under a half a second, I have about a second and a half after pulling that, before I hit the water. And in that time, fortunately, the parachute deployed to slow me enough so I didn't die in impact with the ocean. And then I splashed down in that icy cold Atlantic water. And anybody who's done cold plunging, you know, when you get into 37 degree Fahrenheit water, it's like needles on your skin.
Oh.
And so I feel that all over my body. It's filling up my dry suit, turning my dry suit into like a big sea anchor, pulling me under. The parachute that had just saved my life got drug under that churning ocean water and caught in the currents and started to pull me under.
Lord.
And we have a system on the parachute, riser where it connects to us, our harness. It has what's called a SeaWERS. And what that's supposed to do is it's a saltwater activated explosive device that detonates when it goes into ocean water for this very reason. If you're in a high speed ejection, it's very common for you to have flail injuries. So you can't use your arms to manually disconnect your parachute. And in worst case scenario, now one of the SeaWERS fires, but didn't disconnect. And the other one didn't even fire at all. Oh, so I remained attached to that parachute as it drug me under. Fortunately, my LPU around my neck inflated, and that gave me enough buoyancy that it would pull me up to the surface on occasion. So I could cough up some water, catch a quick breath of air, and then drug back under.
Anybody who's been,
it was
are you kidding? Wow.
It was not good. I don't know how I didn't drown from it, but I got up just enough to catch a breath of air every so often. But anybody who's been held under by a big wave, surfing or for whatever, drown proofing, and you know that feeling when you need a breath of air and you can't get it, or what it feels like to suck in salt water into your lungs, when you start to guppy and your body just automatically starts to suck stuff down your throat when you can't hold your breath anymore. That was just that over and over and over again. And in the meantime, my flight lead, he saw my parachute deploy. He knew there was something wrong. He dropped a GPS position of my location.
Yeah.
And then he coordinated with air traffic control to get some more aircraft on scene to help out. He's on fumes, essentially.
Right.
Because when we started that fight, we were already almost out of fuel where we had to head back to base. And in that time, he spotted a fishing vessel. They weren't answering on maritime guard. So he got down really low and really fast, and he thumped their bow, as we call it. So he blasted over them at low altitude, high airspeed, and got their attention. They spun up to maritime guard, the emergency maritime frequency.
Yeah.
And he was able to direct them over to my rough position. They got on scene. He had to head back to flew a bingo profile back to the base, almost out of fuel. Some other aircraft arrived overhead, keeping an eye on me. And this fishing vessel, luckily, was able to get up close and personal. They threw a rope out to me that just got tangled in all the paracord. They weren't able to really help me much, but they at least provided a visual reference point for where I was. Because at this point, my helmet had ripped off with all the reflective material on it. I was just a little dark head, occasionally bobbing to the surface in this churning Atlantic Ocean, out in the middle of the ocean. So that was fortunate that they were there. In the meantime, two Navy H-60 Seahawk helicopters were coming to my position. One from HS-11 off a nearby aircraft carrier arrived first. Due to a miscommunication and all the chaos of this search and rescue effort, their rescue swimmer jumped into the ocean and thought I was on the fishing vessel, which I wasn't. Luckily, the other helicopter, their pilot spotted my head bobbing in the water. And they're like, hey, there he is. They flew over to my position. Their rescue swimmer, Cheech, jumped in, got down to me. And at this point, I had been in the ocean for about an hour and a half.
An hour and a half?
It was a miracle I was alive. Yeah, I mean, I don't know how I made it that long. He got in, he connected into my harness, and he said that parachute pulled us both underwater. And he had done this in the pool and training and stuff, but he had never been drug under by a parachute out in the open Atlantic and just looked down and you see this dark blue abyss. His, you know, his training kicked in, he cut that paracord loose and got me back to the surface, pulled us up into the helicopter, and they beelined it for Norfolk General, which is a level one trauma center in Norfolk, Virginia. On the flight there, I coded several times. They were doing everything they could to resuscitate me and keep me alive. They eventually got me, I think it was about a 35, 40 minute flight to Norfolk. And when they unloaded me and the medical staff came out, actually a funny part of the story. One of the one of the crew members had just started to eat this meatball sub for his lunch when they got called out on this rescue. And because of the chaos of it all, he didn't get to finish it. He just kind of threw it in the remnants of the wrapper and threw it in the corner of the helicopter.
Yeah.
And in the chaos of my body getting in there, I was covered in a meatball sub. So it looked like, you know, blood and gore. So as they're wheeling me into the hospital, they're like, hey, he's in bad shape, but that's just my lunch, Adam.
That's marinara.
They get me into the hospital. They immediately start treating me for hypothermia. They took my core body temperature. I was at 87 degrees Fahrenheit core body temperature. So I should have been dead from hypothermia. But they said, had I not gotten that severe hypothermia, had my dry suit actually functioned properly, I would have bled to death way before anybody got there from my bleeding brachial artery and my open leg fractures. They treated me for that, multiple blood transfusions. They were doing everything they could to put me back together again. Luckily, they had like the dream team of surgeons on that day. They induced a coma and rushed me into surgery as soon as I was semi-stable. And in there, they did multiple fasciotomies, limb salvage procedures on all four of my limbs. In the past, I would have been a quadriplegic had I survived at all. But thanks to the incredible surgeon's talent in modern medicine, they were able to salvage my limbs from amputation.
Unreal.
They rebuilt my skeleton with titanium rods, steel plates, and screws. So now I've got like a Wolverine skeleton, which is pretty sweet.
Did you ask for the claws?
You know, budget cuts, man.
You gotta be kidding me.
Things are tight right now.
Yeah.
You know, they were able to kind of rebuild me. I spent a week in this induced coma as they completed all these surgeries. They did a brachial artery bypass and managed to keep me going. I was on a ventilator in a vegetative state at this point, and they tried to get me out of the coma. I wasn't coming to. I had a lot of my friends and family and squadron mates were in the ICU waiting room, just waiting to hear if I was going to be all right. And the mood was pretty glum. They didn't know if I was going to be a vegetable or what. And Basil, the guy who right before the flight had been like, oh, you haven't done anything dumb enough yet to earn a call sign. He said, oh, he's a scrappy motherfucker. He'll be fine.
Yeah.
And so they took scrappy motherfucker and they shortened it down to Smurf. And because it's the military, you have to have a politically correct cover story for your call sign. And mine was, I'm a short guy who turned blue from hypothermia. So kind of both were true.
I love that.
And another week in that non-induced coma, and I finally kind of woke up. I had no recollection of the ejection at that point. I didn't know where I was. It was like waking up from a weird dream. And the first thing I thought was that they had tied me down onto this gurney because I couldn't move.
Yeah.
And it was, I thought they had tied this wool blanket down on it, but it was because I was paralyzed. Eventually the docs came in and I think they were just trying to tell me straight, but they said, hey, you're never going to walk again. You're never going to use your arms again. Your flying career is over. And in the back of my mind, I was just kind of like, well, I'm going to prove you guys wrong. And it became my motivation every day to like, show them that I wasn't going to be a vegetable the rest of my life. And little by little, over the course of 3 months, doing every type of therapy known to man,
yeah.
I was loaded up on more pain meds than I can recall, from initially fentanyl and Dilaudid, oxycodone, OxyContin, amitriptyline, tramadol, trazodone, gabapentin, all this stuff, not to mention all the meds that they gave me to counter effect the side effects of all that stuff.
Right.
I had unbearable nerve pain from some of the nerve damage that I had. I mean, it felt like my left leg especially was really bad. It felt like either someone was crushing my foot with pliers or electrocuting it or lighting it on fire or all at the same time. And that would just randomly spike all the time, which made sleep really difficult, made doing everything really difficult. They were just loading me up on all these meds and none of those seemed to be really doing the trick. And then one day this kind of hippie looking doctor came in with long hair and just real mellow vibe. And he said, hey, you want to try this thing? It's called prolotherapy. And for anybody who's dealing with chronic pain, I highly recommend looking this up. It's called prolotherapy.
Okay.
And all it is they take a bag of sugar water, so glucose.
Yeah.
And they take a hypodermic needle, a little syringe, and they fill it up, and then they put this in little subcutaneous pockets, so just underneath your skin, all over the area where you feel the pain. And within about 10 minutes of this procedure that it took, 90% of that nerve pain was gone permanently. Just from having a little bit of sugar water injected underneath my skin and what looked like little mosquito bites. And
can you do this with Snickers? That,
what's that?
Can you do this with Snickers too?
Maybe. Yeah. You dissolve one in a bottle of water and probably do the same thing. You know, if you're in a pinch out in the field. Or
just dissolve the Snickers. That's unbelievable. Wow. Wow.
You know, at this point, it had been about 3 months. I had finally learned how to walk well enough. I could get around with a walker. And I ended up getting to go back to Virginia Beach after being an inpatient all that time at the VA Polytrauma Center in Richmond. I got to go back and started just doing outpatient therapy. Yeah. And little by little, I started to improve. My squadron mate's wife, Amanda, she happened to be a physical therapist. And she started working with me outside the clinic, kind of the gloves off approach. She showed up day one with a Nalgene bottle labeled patient's tears on the side of it. And then she just proceeded to kick my ass into shape.
I love that.
I was walking around with a cane at that point, and she grabbed that cane out of my hand and chucked it. I was like, I never want to see you walk with that thing again. And then she whipped out a deck of cards, and we did this brutal deck of cards workout where I could barely walk. After several more surgeries, I had to go through an investigation and a board for the ejection for the aircraft being lost. And at the end of the day, I ended up at a boardroom across from this admiral, and either side of this big wooden table was flanked by all these, experienced naval aviators to kind of review my case and give me the final verdict if I was ever going to get the chance to go back and fly. At this point, I was still hobbling around, so that looked pretty far out of the question, but they still had to do this proceeding anyway. And the admiral walked into the room, sat down at the head of table, had us all sit down. And the only question he asked me was, he looked across the table and he said, "Lieutenant Gill, are you fearless?" And I just thought for a moment. And the only thing that came to my mind was, I said, "Sir, I don't remember a lot from the ejection, but I'm certain what little pillow there is on that ejection seat, what little cushion there is, was puckered up inside me real tight." And so he just kind of didn't smile. He didn't laugh. He didn't say a word. He just got up and walked out of the room. And I was like, oh man, that didn't go well, maybe. But a few minutes later, one of the more senior ranking officers that was in there came and grabbed me and pulled me to his office. He handed me this jar of Lifesavers, these little mint candies. And I grabbed one, popped it out of the wrapper and into my mouth. And he said, "Congratulations. You're going to get the chance to go back to fly if you can get your body working again." And so that boosted my motivation. You know, I was at fault in part for the accident, but there had been several more experienced pilots that had been injured or killed by that same flight control system feature before me. And I know a guy who after me, who was killed by that same feature, who was a Top Gun graduate, kind of at the prime of his proficiency and skill in the jet.
Yeah.
So I got that opportunity, at least if I could recover. After 2 years of overcoming prescription drug addiction, rehabilitating my body, I was able to literally run circles around dang near everybody in my command. I was a PT stud at that point. And the commodore of the base saw and was like, "Hey, you're going to go back and fly." And and they pushed for me to get all these medical waivers. I had to get this whole stack of medical waivers. And then after 2 years, I was back flying Super Hornets again. And
2 years,
that's kind of, after 2 years, I got the chance to go back and retrain, and I graduated at the top of my class as the top stick, and then went back to VFA 136, the Nighthawks in NAS Lemoore, California. And, it seemed like a dream come true. You know, I felt like I was on top of the world again.
Yeah.
And this is kind of where the Disney version of my story would end. It was a happy ending, but
there's a
twist to the story, and really? It gets even crazier. You know, I had kind of pushed through, I think, a lot of the mental stuff that I was maybe dealing with in the back of my mind. I just shoved it all down. And some of that started to surface. And then I was on a flight down in Tyndall Air Force Base. We were doing a weapons exercise. So I got to fire a live AIM-9 Mike Sidewinder heat-seeking missile at a drone.
Okay.
And then break off and go fight this F-22 Raptor in a dogfight, which was awesome.
Oh man!
And I came back from that flight and I realized watching my tapes in the debrief that I had these big chunks of the flight that were missing from my memory. And I knew something was off. I went back that night to my hotel, tried to sleep, couldn't sleep. I was just on duty the next day. So I was standing squadron duty officer, answering the phone and the radio, coordinating the flight schedule, that kind of stuff. I just kind of toughed it out through the day. And that night, again, I went back to the hotel and I was seriously struggling just with basic function. I sat down on the bed and it felt like the whole room was tumbling around me. I just got really bad vertigo all of a sudden, which I had never experienced before. I was trying to set my alarm on my phone for the time I had to get up for my flight in the morning. And I couldn't do the math or operate my phone's alarm clock to set the alarm. I'd laid down to try to sleep and I just couldn't sleep. My heart was racing. I was having these panic attacks and there had been an issue with decompression sickness in the Super Hornet.
Yeah.
And the Hornets, where the environmental control system was having these malfunctions causing rapid decompression of cabin pressure. And what that can cause, if anybody's a scuba diver, if you come up from depth too quickly, mm-hmm. the nitrogen in your blood can come out of solution. If it gets into your joints, that's called type 1 DCS. But if that gets into your brain, it can cause essentially like an aneurysm or even kill you if you get a blockage in your brain.
Jeez.
So the thought was maybe I got type 2 decompression sickness from a malfunction of the jet that had kind of pushed me over the edge. Yeah. I already had what was likely an unresolved brain injury from the ejection. And now this on top was adding insult to injury. They put me in a hyperbaric chamber overnight. It seemed to help a little bit, but I went in the next morning to talk to the doc and he's like, hey, considering your health record and everything you've been through, when you get back to Lemoore, I need you to go see the flight doc, which is the last thing you want to have
right.
to do after battling to get all these waivers is, you know, raise your hand and say something's wrong.
Yeah.
But I knew exactly. I didn't want to get somebody else hurt or, you know, something bad to happen because I ignored it any longer. So reluctantly, when we got back to California, I went in to see the flight doc. Before long, I had to go see a psychiatrist and psychologist, and I had a delayed onset PTSD diagnosis.
Oh, wow.
And I think that was probably part of it, but there was also this TBI component that was largely overlooked. And the treatment went to drugs very quickly. And I had already been down the road with the drugs, and I'd already gone through all these withdrawals, and I didn't want anything to do with them. But it was painted as the only option was, hey, you got to take these pills. They're going to help you sleep. And before long, I was on one called Seroquel, which is an antipsychotic medication or quetiapine. And that was given to me at low dosage so I could sleep. But my insomnia persisted. I started to get more paranoid and hypervigilant. And as time went on and the dosage went up, it evolved into full-blown psychoses. My wife had just had our little boy. I was trying to be a dad. She's trying to be a mom and take care of this newborn. And she's got me just out of my mind. One minute I thought I was being hunted by government snipers. I stopped eating. I stopped drinking. I stopped going near the windows or going outside.
Oh my gosh.
And it was a struggle for her. And in the back of my mind, I felt like I was letting my whole squadron down. You know, they had put their faith in me to get back flying. And now,
right.
Here's this made up thing in my head that I can't seem to overcome. At least that's the way it was kind of presented. Like hey, this is just all in my head.
Right.
And I got into a pretty dark depression to the point where one night I was ready to put a pistol in my mouth. And the only thing that kept me from doing so was I looked over and my little boy and my wife were sleeping peacefully next to me. And I was like, I can't do that. Anyways, this progressed into a medical board. I was eventually medically retired. Moved back to Northern Michigan, and that cycle, that insane cycle of more psychiatric meds, the worse things got. And that just cycled up to the point where I was on 450 milligrams a night of quetiapine or Seroquel.
Seriously.
And which is like a freaking heroic dose of that stuff.
Yeah.
And within 2 nights of that dose being increased from 300 to 450 milligrams, my wife came home from a job interview. And she heard me rustling around. She found me completely naked. I had shaved off my hair in chunks for some reason, my eyebrows. And the only thing I had on was this black plastic garbage bag tied around my shoulders like a cape, because I thought I was going to go out into the Michigan snowy weather and fight crime like Batman. And so she's like,
this shouldn't be funny, but I mean, come on,
it's
man.
Funny now.
A cape, I naked. Mean,
I think my wife even had to maybe laugh.
She
a
had
little
to
bit.
Chuckle a little bit.
She rushed me to the ER.
Oh man.
I spent a couple nights in the ER, just completely out of my mind in a plexiglass room. They transferred me by ambulance down to Battle Creek, Michigan, where I was admitted into the VA inpatient psychiatric facility there. So the loony bin for veterans. And right. I came to in there. I was in and out of psychoses in there, but I definitely have a lot of lucid memories of what happened. And it was pretty heartbreaking to see the way that they treat veterans in these facilities. I mean,
oh man.
There's these guys just out of their minds, loaded up with drugs against their will. And I had been voluntarily admitted. And when I was like, I don't want to be here anymore, this is not a place for healing, it was like, sorry, you're here and you're not leaving. And as time went on, they kept trying to give me more and more drugs. And as I resisted, I kind of became this problem for them. And I started to plan an escape. I pulled the fire alarm one night, hoping that they had let us out. And those of us that wanted to could make a run for it. A lot of the people in there were just so drugged up, they were like zombies, but that didn't work. And when I tried it, they called in base security. They kind of cornered me, and then they injected me with a medication called Haldol, which made me feel like I just wanted to rip my skin off and run around yelling and screaming. It was just this, it felt like there were insects trying to burrow their way out from underneath my skin. It was absolutely brutal.
Oh my God, Keegan.
And after that, they ended up drugging me up pretty good, to the point where I'm just drooling on myself out of my mind in this stupor. And they called me into a room. And this woman who's supposed to be my legal representation, which I didn't even comprehend at the time.
Yeah.
She had me scribble my name on these pieces of paper. I didn't even know what I was writing. I was just scribbling. I was so out of it. But those documents somehow legally declared me mentally defective permanently. They made it so I'm no longer allowed to purchase a firearm. So I lost my Second Amendment right. And they also put me on the law enforcement information network. So if I'm ever pulled over by the police, I pop up in their system like I had committed a felony.
Oh my gosh.
So here I was, a American veteran in the worst moment of my life. And instead I was detained against my will. I was drugged up out of my mind against my will, fed just garbage food. And then I lost my constitutional right to bear arms as a result of just being in that facility. At this point I was now officially held there, and it didn't matter what I did. But fortunately my family was able to advocate to get me out of there eventually and get me back home. But when I got back home, I was just a different person. I was broken. I was depressed. The only emotion I really felt was anger. Yeah. My little boy would come up and try to play with me, and I would just tell him to go away. I could barely do the dishes. And I was fortunate to come across the book, How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan. Mm-hmm. And my mental capacity was so poor at the time, I could barely read, but I at least retained enough to figure out that, hey, there's this thing called psychedelic assisted therapy that can help people with serious mental health issues and brain injury. And so I reached out to an organization called Veteran Solutions that's kind of been leading the charge with this therapy. I didn't necessarily qualify for their program. They only take people with multiple combat deployments that are largely from the special forces community. I was neither of those things, but they put me in contact with another organization called Warrior Angel Foundation. And as time went on, I got some access to these indigenous medicines, and I started to heal. Not only do these indigenous medicines trigger your brain to go back to the point like you're 3 years old to help neuroregenesis and rebuild the neurons and these connections in your brain, so you actually heal brain injury, but they also seem to heal me on this sort of soul level. And after a couple of years of that stuff, I was back to being very active, competing in ultra endurance events, Nice. I've written a book. I've been doing a lot of public speaking, and I've gotten my life back from a point where they told me the only option you have is to take these drugs the rest of your life, and that's your only hope, which destroyed me.
Yeah.
But I hope by sharing this message, because I know there's a lot of other people out there struggling mm-hmm. this, especially in the veteran and first responder community and just the general population. There's a serious mental health crisis going on. And people think that they're stuck in this hopeless situation where the only option is to take a little pill the rest of your life that makes you feel awful or numb. Yeah. And I'm here to tell you that's not the case. There are other options out there. There's TBI clinics out there that can treat brain injury. And I think there's a huge link between, I guess they now call it PTS, post-traumatic stress, and TBI. And even if you haven't been exposed to impacting the sound barrier or explosions or gunfire or whatever, you can still get TBI, micro TBI, from just chronic stress. And we all live in this world of oversaturation and all the craziness. So anyways, I hope this at least reached with one person out there who's maybe in the same spot I was a couple years ago. And just know you don't have to be hopeless, man. And you're not alone.
Keegan, man. I'm sitting here, got chills, and just your message and the way that you're able to talk about it and be honest with everybody. That's such a powerful thing. And, you know, I want to ask you one question here too, of, you know, what does it mean to be able to be that father that you wanted to be, that husband that you wanted to be now, because you took the steps, because you made that choice to not be that person you didn't want to be? What does that mean to you?
Yeah. I mean, they're the greatest gift in my life is my family and my kids, and they've kept me going through a lot of this and pulled me out of the dark spots. And I'm so grateful to have them and to be the father for them. And I think of all that I've been through, and I think the real reason I made it through all that was so I can be here and be the father I am now.
How hard is it to look at the mindset that you had? Because I think a lot of people are always worried about going back to that mindset of when I was in that dark place, because they're like, maybe I'll go back there and we'll be able to get out. How is it hard for you to look back at that and go, gosh, that was who I was? Or is it good for you to look back at that and go, that's who I was, this is who I am now?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, when you're in it, you don't realize how bad you are.
Right.
I mean, you just get so used to being like that, you don't realize it. But now I'm, in a way, I'm grateful to be able to look back and see that that's where I was then, and this is where I am now. I'm so much better than that. And you know, it's in life's a constant continuation. It's not just period dot and that's over.
Right.
It's a constant process now to maintain my mental health, my physical well-being. And I'm doing that largely through, you know, staying active and a mindfulness practice with meditation or whatever you want to call it. Some people just pray or whatever you want to call it, having that moment of silence with yourself and your divinity to kind of decompress from the crazy world we live in. And it's a continuous process but now I know how to do it. And now I know the healthy steps and the things to avoid to prevent going back into that world of darkness that I was in for so long.
That's so powerful. I've got to ask you, because it almost, in my mind, it seems like it equates, because it's a lot of times when you have the mental health issues, it's seconds, it's minutes that you're having to make that decision of whether I'm going to, you know, commit suicide or whether I'm going to hurt myself or whether something's going to go wrong, you know, similar to what you had to do with your ejection. How do you create that mindset of kind of like how you trained as a pilot? How do you create that mindset so that you can have that reaction to hit that ejection, you know, pull the ejection lever in that moment when you feel like it's done, when you're done, and be able to come out on the other side like you have?
Yeah, I hope we can continue to connect with one another, reaching out to people and let them know you're hurting. when you're in those moments, it's really hard because you think you're all alone and nobody cares about you. And why would they care about you? But the truth is a lot of people do. And if you just reach out and make those connections, and even, and I think that's a beautiful thing about what you're doing with these podcasts, is you're sharing these messages that can help inspire hope to people that are listening. And, we're fortunate to live in a time where there's this flow of information and these messages out there. So I hope that you can keep hope. I hope you can have that little flicker of light in the darkness. Because everybody goes through these moments, whether we want to talk about it or not. And, yeah, let's just be there for each other and know you can always reach out, and people don't want you to end your life. And there's people that need you. And when you can get through that darkness, there's a saying I really love. It's, in order to have branches that can reach the heavens, you have to have roots that have been deep into hell. And we've all been through those hells, whatever those are. But those, if you can get through them and grow out of them, you're going to be that much stronger going forward.
And that's a perfect quote to end it. I love it. I got three questions for it. Keegan, it's been such an honor to hear your story. And that quote is just it hits the top. But you ready for these three questions?
Yeah, fire away.
All right. If you could go back to your 18-year-old self and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that be?
Ooh, man, that guy needed a lot of advice.
One's not going to help it at all.
I think it it would be, always remember you are connected to everyone and everything around you.
That's a good one. That's a good one. Second one, kind of you've alluded on things that I can do, but everybody has challenges and struggles. If you could give them two habits to incorporate into their daily life so they can continue to live forward instead of backwards and continue to aspire to be that potential that they should be, what would those two habits be?
Yeah, I would say the two really important ones are develop some sort of physical regime that you do every day of some sort. And if you're starting out and you haven't been active for a long time, maybe all that means is go for a 5-minute walk starting out, but that's going to turn into a 10-minute walk and then maybe a 10-minute jog. And then, you know, as the years go on, that's going to turn into you freaking deadlifting 400 pounds on the regular and running marathons. So build that physical practice, as brutal as that's going to be, if you've not incorporated that in your life for a while, that is huge. Because with your physical body being healthy, it makes your brain healthy. And when all that stuff starts working together, you feel better, you look better, and you grow into your full capabilities as a human. And the second piece that's probably even more important than the physical one is build some sort of mindfulness practice. And this is really tough. Just as if you hadn't worked out in 20 years, trying to go run a mile is brutal. Well, if you've never done any sort of mindfulness techniques, sitting down to try to meditate for 5 minutes can be brutal as well. Your mind's racing. You've got a million other things going through your head. But if you can just sit down for 5 minutes at first, take some deep breaths, and just try to silence all the noise in your mind, all the thoughts that are just constantly racing by, and just try to give yourself at least just a little break from that. There's a number of different apps out there that you can get. I know the VA has a free meditation app that can help you get started. There's an app called, I think it's called Mindfulness. That's a meditation app, if you don't mind spending a few bucks on it. And there's also a free training course on Veterans Path website. I think it's just veteranspath.com. But they have I think it's a 12 or 14 lesson step-by-step program that can introduce you to some basic breathing techniques and get you like a very basic meditation practice that you can start to grow and cultivate. And just like the way your physical body will grow with time and consistency. And I'm not saying you got to go out and run a marathon every day. In fact, don't do that, because you'll be broken no matter who you are. But if you can just consistently do something active every day with your body and something to practice a mindfulness thing every day, even if it's just 5 minutes of each.
Yeah.
you will see results that'll grow and build upon one another if you can stay with it consistent and have some discipline with it.
See, when the Smurf talks, you listen.
Yeah, right. I love it. Tell my wife that.
You let me know, I'll just record it. All right, the last question, this one's always fun. If you could have coffee at a firehouse table, so in other words, you can ask any question and it's going to be answered, with three people, they can be deceased or alive, who would those three be?
Oh man. Three people, yep, having this coffee
at a firehouse deceased table or alive.
Let's see, how about well, Thich Nhat Hanh,
okay,
Jesus,
yeah,
and John Belushi.
Oh man, you hit it out of the park in that one. Oh, I love it. Well, Kendall, it has been such a, or Keegan, I'm sorry, Keegan, has been such an honor to have you on today. And you know, your story is impactful, and what you're doing now is even more impactful. And I hope that you just continue to aspire to be that inspiration to everybody.
Thanks for having me on, Rob, and giving me the opportunity to share this. And yeah, I hope it reaches some folks in need. And maybe sparks that little bit of hope they needed.
And it definitely will. Make sure you look up Keegan Gill. You can, he has amazing stories on YouTube. He is, I mean, if you just Google him like I did, you're going to find a bunch of stuff. And there's always more to the story, and there's a lot of things that he supports. Actually, why don't you, you said you have a bunch of things that you support. I want to give you that time and platform because I think it could help a lot of people as well.
Yeah. And I'd be happy to share this list with you if you can put it in the show notes or something, yep, just so people have a reference. But yeah, I'm here not only because of my family and my squadron mates and all the support I've had that on that side, but also through a wide variety of veteran nonprofit organizations that have kind of been filling the gap and getting guys better, healing from whatever trauma they've been through. Mm-hmm. And just to list them in order that I've utilized them, Operation Surf, followed by Warrior Angels Foundation, Wake for Warriors, Vet Solutions, Defenders of Freedom, 62 Romeo, man, what else? No Fallen Heroes. I'll have to send you a list because,
yeah, we'll make sure to put those in the notes for everybody who's listening that they can utilize those. But you heard his story, and you've heard the power of being able to have a support network, and Keegan, all these ones that helped you, I think we'll be able to help others to be able to find theirs.
Yeah, know that there's a network of over 300 plus and growing of these nonprofit organizations that are doing everything they can to help people get better, because they know there's these gaps, and largely the people that found these organizations have fallen through those gaps and they've managed to crawl their way out on their own, and they know that there's a void that needs to be filled. I'll send you those as well, and please reach out, and don't think that you shouldn't or you don't deserve it or whatever. My story is not as crazy as that. I don't deserve this care. People don't care about all that. Just reach out. You'd be amazed how much help there is if you just say you need some.
Love that. Keegan, thank you again for joining me today.
Thanks again, Rob.
Thanks for listening and supporting the Forged in the Fires podcast with Fireman Rob. Remember, don't forget to like and subscribe to this podcast. And please share this episode with a friend or family member. To find out more about Fireman Rob, or if you have a question, go to www.firemanrob.com. Until next time, live your life forged in the fires.